You're listening live to the 13th episode of the Armand and Akul Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Akil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 24th of February, 2024, at 5.06 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hkmim-speaking Musqueam people. Armand, so you're on call this week, hey? Past 2 weeks?
Just the last week.
Okay. So that's how long do these things last usually?
Yeah, just a week.
What's the likelihood you get paged during the show?
Pretty low. Yeah.
If you did get paged, what's the likelihood it's something like meltdown level?
Yeah, no, pretty low. It's all right. Now you're doing the board, so nobody will know. I can get paged and you can just talk to people about rainbows and unicorns and
obviously do a stellar job of managing these boards, which obviously I've been doing meticulously this evening.
Yeah, fantastically. There were no errors or missteps so far today. How are things for you?
Good. I have a bit of travel coming up over the next 2 weeks. I'm in Victoria for most of this week, from Monday to Thursday, and Nanaimo on Thursday. And I'm going to be in Montreal the week after that. And I'm going to our friend's hometown of St. John's. Yeah, Newfoundland.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You're really traveling the country. Are you thinking of a political campaign? Are you?
Well, he starts with canvassing, seeing what the fisher folk of that live by the Grand Banks think, and you take it from there. The polling's good there, Why not? Yeah. Next step, Alberta.
Cool, 2020, whatever, 2025. So, speaking of elections, what are we talking about today?
So this is kind of another special, interesting episode where we...
You claim it's interesting. It's a bold claim.
That's the only claim that matters. where we dissect and discuss important events that are happening in the news. And I think on today's episode, confidently on today's episode, we will be playing and reacting clips from around the world. What are the regions of the world that we're going to be hitting on?
Yeah. So we're going to hit on here, Russia.
Home? Oh, here, comma, Russia.
We live in Russia now. So Canada's being taken over.
Who knew that piece by Tucker Carlson was just so powerful it made you move to Russia?
No, it just made Canada succeed. Like, it was just passed in the Canadian Parliament.
It made Canada Russia.
Yeah, like Trudeau was like, that was so moving. I'm just going to announce the secession of
Canada. I love how strong this man is.
Yeah. Just he alpha meat. And now we're part of Russia. So yeah, we're going to be talking about Canada, Russia, United States, South Africa, Middle East, India.
Bharat.
So
why don't you start us off with this poem that we have for the top of the show?
Yeah, so let me just give some motivation. 2024 is kind of a year of a lot of elections. I think probably one of the most elections, you've got India, all the countries I listed basically have elections here, India, US, Russia, United Kingdom, all sorts of South Africa, all sorts of important countries. And at the same time, it is a period of, rising, ethno-nationalism and global war and conflict, and in the Ukraine and in the Middle East. And it does remind me of, kind of, as a student of history, I love people say they're students of history. As a student of history, the pre-World War I kind of era, or even pre-World War II era. And this is a poem from that time. It's by William Butler Yeats. And I think Akil really likes the name Yeats.
I'm just along for the ride, man.
Let me just read this. It's called The Second Coming. Let me read it. Turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image, outer spiritus mundi, troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmares by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come around at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born.
That's very moving.
And
I think that's a perfect note, especially speaking of passionate intensity. Let's hear from Canadian opposition leader Pierre Poilievre, who is speaking to a gaggle of reporters in this clip.
The carbon tax was inserted by Justin Trudeau, not by my supporters. Why did he do that? No, but I'm just curious. Can you explain to me why there is a carbon tax in the agreement?
No, but the question is why.
No, I ask you a question. You keep asking about the agreement.
We're the journalists. We ask the questions.
I have the freedom to ask questions if I want to, and I've just answered. I've been answering your questions all week.
Here's another one.
So, no.
The government's introducing why would there be a carbon tax?
You're not changing the subject. I know you want to change the subject.
No, I want to ask
because you don't want to talk about Trudeau's carbon tax.
I want to ask a question because in a democracy, we ask the question and you answer.
And I decide the answer I give. And the answer, is this: we will axe the tax. And Trudeau can try to divide Canadians by putting a carbon tax and a free trade agreement that we already had for years. It won't change a thing.
It's misleading.
Because I will axe the tax, and I will axe the tax with delight and with passion and with incredible speed. So when I'm Prime Minister, you will be shocked at the speed with which I will axe the tax. And the Canadian people will be able to look up at the gas stations and see the prices coming down. And Trudeau can try to distract from his hated carbon tax by putting it in a free trade amendment to a pre-existing agreement. It won't stop me because I will axe the tax, Thank you.
But not on industrial.
So what did you think about that line of questioning?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Questioning by Pierre Poilievre of the reporters or the reporter of Pierre Poilievre?
Excellent question. Not something that usually comes up when you're talking about the questions that a political leader usually fields, but I think both ways, to be honest.
Yeah. I feel like overall Pierre Poilievre is taking a strategy of, becoming the enemy of the media, of the mainstream media. I think that has pluses and minuses. I think, I'm starting to see it also, not just this particular clip, but there's like a slew of articles coming out of, him, stumbling over questions and, giving slightly weird answers about, whether it was about like having a registry of what, people's online activities were and stuff like that. So I think it's a dangerous strategy to be so competitive, and it's kind of concerning just from a media standpoint. Like, we are journalists, or allegedly we have a radio show, it is a bit concerning. And passion intensity is great. Himself said it. He's got
all passionate. He's
got the speed.
That's the speed at which he's going to axe the tax. Yeah, and this is a tried and tested playbook. By people on the right across the world.
And authoritarian kind of people more generally.
Yeah. Most, I guess, really close to home is the United States. And it's also concerning that this is a leader who does not do interviews generally, unless it's, there was the interview with some local newspaper. And then, of course, the journalist in that question there wasn't really well equipped to answer to kind of go up against the national a national politician like Pierre Poilievre, who really is very quick with his answers. It's really concerning to have to have that mix of somebody who doesn't do interviews and also whenever he does, just ask the reporters questions instead of actually providing any answers.
Yeah, yeah. And there was another clip played a couple of episodes ago.
Exactly.
That was similar.
All the while, by the way, saying things like, why won't Justin Trudeau answer these questions? Why won't he answer my question? But you won't answer anyone's
and,
questions.
You know, just to be real, he's like 20 points ahead in the polls right now, or some crazy number.
Exactly.
He is basically the prime minister in waiting for the next year unless something dramatic happens, right? So, you know, people are going to start viewing him not as an opposition leader to Justin Trudeau, but kind of as he is basically the prime minister to be maybe a year and a half from now.
Exactly.
So, you know, he kind of needs, I would like to see him, you know, actually answer questions, but who knows?
Yeah. Before we move on, do you believe you have a right in this country, Roman, to ask questions to reporters?
You just asked me that question, which is making me really uncomfortable. So I'm going to ask you that question.
Let me reframe that. How comfortable do you feel in this country asking questions to reporters?
Yeah, well, this whole exchange is making me super uncomfortable. So I think we better move on. I just realized Pierre Poilievre has a point. This is a very uncomfortable exercise.
I will concede everything to the man. He makes excellent points.
And the passion is
no
great.
No one should ask anyone questions. Let's move on to, speaking about this current government and, you know, Prime Minister in waiting, there's some pretty exciting news that came out this past week with the NDP and the Liberals having reached a pharmacare deal.
Yeah, potentially exciting. Let's see what actually is in the nitty-gritty, right?
Absolutely.
The legislation will be in March.
It'll be tabled on March 1st.
March 1st, yeah. So, just for context, you know, they had this kind of agreement with the Liberals to support them, and one of the cornerstones of the agreement would there be a single-payer pharmacare plan.
Exactly.
That comes with a much bigger kind of budgetary ask than the dental plan. And I think they're kind of narrowly focusing on insulin and... Or was the other one?
Birth control.
Yeah. I think, sounds promising. And I think that at this point, the main takeaway is that we won't have an election till next year.
Exactly.
This just guarantees that.
Yeah. And just some context on this proposed deal. And of course, we don't have any details yet, right? We'll have to see when the legislation is actually brought forward in Parliament. The NDP says the deal includes full coverage for contraceptives. I'm quoting here. The NDP says the deal includes full coverage for contraceptives close to what British Columbia covers, which includes birth control pills, IUDs, and emergency contraception. It also includes insulin for type 1 and type 2 diabetes, as well as additional diabetes drugs. The focus is on covering generics where there is an option to do so. Ozempic, a new drug for diabetes that has been used off-label as a weight loss drug, will not be covered under the agreement. And just to finish off, the deal also puts forward a fund to help provinces cover the cost of insulin pumps for diabetes patients, unquote. So pretty exciting. But of course, we'll have to wait for the details of that to come out. So speaking of, that will obviously alleviate
cost of living.
Lot of stress in people's pocketbooks. But cost of living is a significant issue. It's been an issue for years now, and it's only getting worse. There have been many factors blamed on the cost of living crisis. I think more recently we've seen a group being blamed for the cost of living crisis, at least having contributed significantly to it. So this next clip is about the housing crisis.
And how Canadians' perceptions of it change.
Exactly. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about whether or not what your experience has been of Canadians blaming?
Let's play the clip first, then we'll talk about it. Yeah, I think it's what's interesting is that, you know, historically, Canadians have been very pro-immigration, and now we're just starting to see that change a little bit.
Okay, let's take a listen.
A new poll suggests that support for increased immigration is faltering. The online Léger poll found that 75% of respondents agreed an increase in newcomers is adding strain to both the housing market and healthcare system. Now, the same amount acknowledged higher immigration contributes to cultural diversity, while a majority agreed young immigrants contribute to the workforce and tax base. Nearly half of those who answered the online survey said Canada should welcome fewer immigrants. Well,
it's quite interesting. It's quite, I think it's, you know, there, Canada has probably the lowest housing per capita of, I think, any G7 country. And I think one of the lowest in its own history. And, you know, the wages and the hourly pay of Canadians compared to the cost of housing is amongst the highest in the world, especially in a place like Vancouver. So I think...
And Canada has seen the largest increase in average house home prices across the country of any G7 country in the past 20 years.
Yeah, and I think that combined with, I think recently there was a huge wave of Indian international students and, you know, a lot of kind of sketchy universities that weren't real universities kind of offered opportunities for these international students. And they came here, and then there wasn't actually any legit thing for them to do.
For sure.
And I think that's kind of also contributed to this kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, which is kind of concerning and I think I'm starting to see it's going to start manifesting in terms of maybe more kind of... Like, Canada is, I think, too diverse to be, like, truly ethno-nationalist because... You know, like I think over 20% of people have like Asian heritage here. You've got like a large, you know, Francophone population here who have their own kind of rivalry with the Anglophone population here. So I think it's too diverse for that to happen. But there would be maybe some sort of, anti-xenophobic kind of sentiment.
And 3 in 4 is a significant percentage of, obviously, even accounting for whatever the error the polls have, it's a significant number of people who believe that immigration is making the housing crisis worse.
And it's kind of wild. Like Canada is the second largest country by land area in the world.
Yeah.
And it has a population of around Tokyo or something.
Right.
So it's just a matter of like, you know, a lot of zoning restrictions in the cities and stuff, maybe planning and those kind of issues and the cost of constructing housing that's kind of, you know, limiting the supply of housing. You know, in the past, there were issues of like vacant homes as well, and you know, people using homes as investment vehicles. That's still, you know, still going on to some degree. But there have been like a lot of restrictions on vacant, at least in British Columbia, a lot of restrictions on vacant homes and things like that.
And this is interesting because this is a conversation. This was part of a conversation I had with my grandfather. And he said, like, he asked the same question. He said, "How is it that the second largest country in the world by land area?" Is having a housing crisis. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I tried to explain, zoning, and he said, "Yeah, but those are things you can change. So what's stopping you from changing these laws?" And there's significant opposition, right? People want their lawns, people want their views.
One option, if you can't get your lawns or your views, is to apparently move to Russia.
Step one, sell all of your possessions in Canada. Step two, take your family, well, most of your family, and move to Russia. Which is exactly what the Saskatchewan family did. They were beet farmers in Saskatchewan, and they were terribly, terribly disappointed. By the way, they didn't move because of the cost of living crisis, which... probably a fair reason to want to move from the country, which is something, you know, the economic conditions of any place make people want to move, right? Yeah. Which is one of the ways you can influence people's actions in government is by kind of tinkering with it to make it more attractive to move to another place. But this family decided that Canada was just too woke, too left-wing ideology being taught in schools. So Arend and his wife, Anissa Feenstra, relocated their family from Canada to Russia to escape perceived LGBT ideology encroachment. And you're never going to, you're going to be shocked with what happened when they went to Russia.
What happened? Please, please, please to enlighten me, Akil.
So they arrive in Russia and their bank accounts were frozen almost immediately
Because Russian banks apparently, like our banks here, have know your customer restrictions where you need to prove the source of your funds. Except, of course, in Russia, it's more like, do you know where these funds are from? Yes or no? Yes, I do. Here's the proof. Oh, you don't speak Russian? Sorry. You don't know where these funds are from. Which is a dramatic reenactment of pretty much what happened to them. Now, it gets in more interesting. So they go there. They realize it's not this utopia that they thought in their head. So the wife, Anissa Feenstra, posts on YouTube basically saying that she was very done with this country. The moment you had to, quote, engage logic, unquote, things started falling apart in the country, basically saying that you can't work with any logic in Russia. And
is that like the Russian reversal situation going on?
So, as you can imagine, in Russia, it's a bastion of freedom, free speech, democratic values. She was made to delete the video almost immediately because she said, quote, because she was, quote, very disappointed in this country at this point, unquote. Anyway, they made an apology video the following day.
So, you know, in Canada, you're disappointed with your country. In Russia, the country is disappointed with you.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's going on.
That's the JFK quote of the 21st century.
You know,
ask not what Canada can do for you. Ask what you can do for Russia.
but
this is interesting, right? Because it kind of goes to the whole this whole idea that Canada and the Western and you know countries in the Western Hemisphere like Canada, I mean, the United States, have deteriorated to such an extent that the former left bloc countries like Russia are paragons.
Yeah, and I think now, especially since like it's a wartime economy, like the whole country's been mobilized for war. Like, why would you want to move there?
Yeah, if you had done this in 2021, even with COVID and everything, you'd say, okay, you're moving on ideological grounds.
Yeah, but even like it'll be interesting. You stay a year, like even go back 10 years, maybe. You know, it'll be interesting, like a cultural experiment. Whatever.
Absolutely.
But now you're like literally in a wartime economy.
With the current context, yeah, it's completely bonkers. And they moved with 8 of their 9 children. So they moved their
entire
family.
Children. And I'm just blown away
absolutely.
By the 9 children.
They don't speak a smack of Russian, right? None of them.
So the 9th child, what did they do with him?
That's a good question.
I think that's something we have to find out about.
But yeah, if you are just let's go to an ad break very quickly. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand and Nikhil show on CRTR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about what's happening in Russia.
Mark your calendar for February 29th, 2024, because the Study and Go Abroad Fair is coming to Vancouver at the Vancouver Convention Center. Don't miss this free opportunity to start planning your next step in education at the undergraduate or postgraduate level, or to travel abroad. Meet with top universities, graduate schools, and professional schools from Canada and around the world to learn about the university and college programs on offer, scholarships, as well as travel, work, and volunteer opportunities worldwide. To learn more or to register for free, please visit studyandgoabroad.com and join us February 29th at the Vancouver Convention Center.
MRG Live presents Zahara at the Fox Cabaret on March 26, 2024. Hailing from LA's Highland Park, Zahara makes detailed melodic indie rock that flits between shoegaze, post-punk, and dream pop. Their airy melodies, pensive guitar, and heart-churning lyrics join to create a dreamy indie rock. Don't miss Zahara at the Fox Cabaret on March 26th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th. With support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Armand and Akil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special episode where we tackle news stories from the past month. Let's go to Russia, where an upstanding American journalist had a hard-hitting interview with the Russian president.
Nord Stream.
You for sure.
I was busy that day. I mean, have you achieved your aims?
No, we haven't achieved our aims yet, because one of them is denazification. This means the prohibition of all kinds of neo-Nazi movements. This is one of the problems that we discussed during the negotiation process, which ended in Istanbul early this year.
Would you be satisfied with the territory that you have now?
I will finish answering the question. You just asked a question about neo-Nazism and denazification. Look, the president of Ukraine visited Canada. This story is well known, but being silenced in the Western countries. The Canadian parliament introduced a man who, as the speaker of the parliament said, fought against the Russians during the World War II. Well, who fought against the Russians during the World War II? Hitler and his accomplices. It turned out that this man served in the SS troops. He personally killed Russians, Poles, and Jews. The SS troops consisted of Ukrainian nationalists who did this dirty work. The president of Ukraine stood up with the entire parliament of Canada and applauded this man. How can this be imagined? The president of Ukraine himself, by the way, is a Jew by nationality.
Really, my question is, what do you do about it? I mean, Hitler's been dead for 80 years. Nazi Germany no longer exists. And so, true. And so, I think what you're saying is you want to extinguish or at least control Ukrainian nationalism. But how? How do you do that?
Послушайте меня. Ваш вопрос очень тонкий.
Listen to me. Your question is very subtle, and I can tell you what I think. Do not take offense.
Of course. Can you imagine?
So that was Tucker Carlson's interview with Vladimir Putin. What did you think, Armand?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I think the important context that, you know, we bring up, of course, is that Russia is having its election so-called in less than a month. They just had Alexei Navalny, a prominent Russian opposition activist, died under mysterious circumstances in a Russian penal colony. We're actually looking up this up before the show. It's called IK3. It's this like godforsaken place, like steps from the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
The extreme north. Russia is already a very northern country, like in the extreme northern tip of Russia. It was made by Gulag workers during the Stalin era. It's really like a kind of deathly place. Anyway.
The town's called Karp, yeah. And it's at the same like longitude as Yekaterinburg, where the last Tsar and his family were held and killed, yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting to see American journalists kind of trying to humanize, Russian dictator.
Journalists in heavy italics, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, this is what, this is the same way we are journalists, same way Pierre Polyev is apparently a journalist.
Yes.
Same way Tucker Carlson is a journalist. I think there are a lot of, I think, hilarious clips. I could just listen to the entire thing and the whole episode. And, you know, Tucker Carlson, the moment he came back, he issued a very strongly worded statement condemning Navalny's death.
Yeah.
But,
It's interesting with Tucker Carlson because he said
Navalny's death was, you know, was not good. It's unacceptable. It was you don't kill political opponents. But also, look at the shopping carts in Russian grocery stores.
Yeah, he did this weird,
pretty sweet.
Yeah, we probably don't have to play those clips, but like others can check it out online. That there are these. Yeah, he goes on this shopping expedition and he's like, you can put coins in the shopping carts. This is freedom.
Yeah, and then you get the coin back, so you don't take it back to your homeless encampment. Yeah. What a paradise.
Yeah, and then he like falls in love with the bread. Like, that's something that doesn't exist elsewhere in the world. Anyway, speaking of, the growing Russian sphere of influence, let's hear from CPAC. What's happening with CPAC?
Conspiracy theorist Jack Posobiec. At CPAC, in a panel hosted by Steve Bannon.
I just wanted to say, welcome to the end of democracy. We're here to overthrow it completely. We didn't get all the way there on January 6th, but we will endeavor to get rid of it and replace it with this right here. We'll replace it with this right here.
Amen.
That's right, because all glory is not to government, all glory to God.
Yeah, and what he was holding in his hand was a cross, a crucifix. So just for our listeners, CPAC is a conservative super PAC that supports, it's most prominent one that supports the Republican Party. And Steve Bannon was at one point a chief advisor to, strategic advisor to Donald Trump, very big weight in the kind of nationalist wing of the Trump movement. And yeah, the guy actually laughing, I believe that's Steve Bannon.
That is Steve Bannon, that's correct.
In the background. And yeah, they're just openly...
his raspy, like, villain laugh, yeah.
Yeah, they're openly plotting overthrowing democracy. And what I find fascinating about it is the way they use joking and laughter and smiles. It's I actually do something similar. I like to joke about serious topics, but they literally, doing it about the end of democracy and overthrowing democracy.
For sure.
It's fascinating.
And they're doing it as, the difference between, joking about serious topics as an external observer as opposed to being part of the movement that is causing a certain event. So there's a difference between being an observer of January 6th and making jokes about it and going, look, the hall of democracy, it's a shining city on the hill. And being one of the people actually breaking into the Capitol making those jokes.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a difference, right? And I did find that very interesting as well. And it isn't funny to the rest of us because of how we all know that this is true. This is what they think. And they're just saying it out loud now and going, haha, no, I don't actually mean it.
No, they're not even saying that don't actually mean it part. They only would say that later if you accuse them. But like, if you look at the entire, he's talking about God and like,
sure,
so it's.
But I mean, in the whole timeline, they get called out for something and then they say, oh, no, I didn't mean it like that. You guys just can't take a joke.
Yeah, you don't know jokes. Yeah. So it's quite interesting. But we have a champion to fight this wave who is a gazillion years old and is fumbling over his words.
And what is this champion's, what is this superhero's epithet?
I don't know. Tell me.
Let's take a listen to Dark Brandon's interaction with right-wing media.
Something the special counsel said in his report is that one of the reasons you were not charged is because... In his description,
that is
you
Peter
are a
Ducey
well-meaning
from Fox News.
Elderly man with a poor memory.
I'm well-meaning and I'm an elderly man and I know what the hell I'm doing. I've been president and I put this country back on its feet. I don't need his recommendation. That's
How
totally
bad
out.
Is your memory and can you continue as president?
My memory is so bad I let you speak.
It's pretty good. Once in a while he like... He's got this grandpa energy. Like, my grandpa's the same way. He'll just, like, I think my grandpa's, like, 90 years old. And he'll just, like, throw out, I'm going to actually have dinner with him after the show. But, like, he'll throw out these, like, great one-liners. Just, like, that's amazing worker art. And he's got that very strong energy. So this is the last hope of, we've got this guy, Dark Brandon, to defeat the forces of... emerging ethno-nationalism while enabling them in Israel. But I think we'll talk about that a bit later.
So on that note, we're going to take another short break. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to the Irmán and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be wrapping up our coverage with South Africa and the ICJ case on Palestine after this.
And some India stuff.
And some India stuff.
F7 Entertainment presents hardcore punk band Military Gun, performing cuts from their critically acclaimed album Life Under the Gun in Vancouver on Friday, March 8th at the Rickshaw Theater. Catch them in Vancouver before their upcoming performances at Bonnaroo and Coachella this year. Tickets on sale now at f7entertainment.com.
MRG Live presents Zahara at the Fox Cabaret on March 26, 2024. Hailing from LA's Highland Park, Zahara makes detailed melodic indie rock that flits between shoegaze, post-punk, and dream pop. Their airy melodies, pensive guitar, and heart-churning lyrics join to create a dreamy indie rock. Don't miss Zahara at the Fox Cabaret on March 26, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th, with support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
Welcome back to the Irmán and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special episode where we tackle news stories from the past month. Irmán, what is at stake in South Africa?
So we have elections coming up in a couple of months. I think it's in towards the end of May. And we, this is kind of the first election. South Africa has a proportional system, including the president is elected proportionally. And this is the first time the ruling party, the African National Congress, it's over a 100-year-old party, has a chance of dropping below 50% since we got, universal suffrage and free elections in 1994. It's a big deal. I think high level, people have just been voting in the ANC time and time again. It started off as this, great, kind of revolutionary party with Nelson Mandela and all that jazz. And they've become really corrupt over the years. And people, kind of, I think especially people in the West, can look in and say, oh, these uneducated people, why are they voting for people who like openly steal from them? But the way I think about it is it's kind of, we actually do very similar things here. Like, for example, I think a good example is like something like the iPhone. The first time the iPhone came out, it was this incredible revolutionary product. And like people were tripping over themselves to part with their cash to get the new iPhone. The newer iPhones are pretty much almost the same. They're not actually adding any new value. But people still do that, right? Because it has a great brand. Absolutely. And that there's a tail period to any brand that it just takes some time for people to realize that they're kind of getting conned. So that's kind of my perspective on things. This clip is from, I think, a member of Build One South Africa. It's one of the small, very obscure parties that are starting to crop up in South Africa. Basically, the way the ANC will fall below 50% is not necessarily that there'll be some other party that is emerging. It's just that there are a couple of two kind of semi-medium-sized parties, and there are going to be a lot of very little parties that are just going to gnaw away at the ANC support. And here's a member of one of them, Ayanda Ali Payne.
Those political parties that want to make a difference, want to make it into parliament, your reaction to this particular speech? See, we got exactly what we expected. Big English, reasonable delivery, eloquence here and there, but it is a very empty, devoid of truth and impotent address Firstly, I have held this microphone that you're holding nonstop. I've walked through the corridors of...
So, just for context, she's talking about the State of the Nation address given by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, and this is her reaction to it. Please go.
Parliament, I can tell you now for free, the ANC government neither has the desire nor the ability to implement anything that the president has had to say. And they are inhibiting good and well-meaning civil servants from doing the same. Where are the bullet trains? Where are the houses of Alex? Where is the smart city? Where is the uninterrupted power supply? And yet the president has the sheer audacity, the gall, the liver to speak about things like state capture as if they were committed by aliens from outer space. Mr. President, you were the deputy president during state capture. It was you who enabled state capture. It was you who supported it. And even now as we speak, you're aiding and abetting, because those who are responsible for state capture were right there with you in that room. And in closing, Slee, he then speaks about Dintswalo. Well, may God have mercy on her soul. She's living in an RDP house that is falling apart because it was built
RDP
with
housing
inferior
is government
material
housing.
So that politicians can get kickbacks. She goes to a hospital with no doctors, even though there are a dime a dozen ministers in the presidency. She goes to a school with dilapidated infrastructure. Her parents don't have jobs, and don't get me started on NAFSIS, because it has not even paid her registration, and yet children are going through orientation as we speak. So, Mr. President, we are not measuring South Africa against any developed country or even developing country. We are measuring South Africa against its own potential. We are lacking, we are regressing, and it is not because of anything other than the ANC government. Thank you.
So, Ramon, could you speak a little bit about what state capture is?
Yeah, so basically, it's what happened during the previous president, Jacob Zuma, is effectively there was a family, they're called the Gupta's Indian family, who exercised so much control over the president that they would just call up people and offer them cabinet positions in return for political favors and tenders.
Basically like a pay-for-play scheme.
Yeah, but like they had the ability to offer cabinet positions. Like they could just say, okay, if you approve this tender, we'll make you cabinet minister. He was, as the speaker mentioned, the current president was Jacob Zuma's deputy president, during his second term, where most of the state capture stuff came out, and he was completely supporting him that whole time. And so it is, there's kind of a bit of people's, trying to make people forget the actual situation at that time. Right now, Jacob Zuma has actually started his own political party called Umkhonto weSizwe, which means Spear of the Nation. And that actually is a callback to the armed wing of the ANC. It's kind of very mysterious why he's doing these things. But anyway, he's they tried to arrest him. There were riots. So he's a free man. It's kind of the country's in a very kind of on a knife's edge. I think for probably one of the first times, an election that's actually going to be quite closely contested, and then the era of coalition politics is probably going to start emerging in South Africa after this election, which is in some ways exciting, but also can be quite nervous if certain coalitions form. It could be quite disastrous for the country.
Of course, and the direction it's going to take, right?
Yeah.
Of course. Let's move to India, which has its own share of challenges, as you and I have discussed before.
And its own Congress party.
And its own Congress party, that's right. So India, just for a little bit of context, India has a very strong prime minister right now, in the sense that he's very popular in the country. This is Narendra Modi. He's very popular. His party the coalition does have a majority in parliament. And leading up to the elections that are going to happen later this year, there's a general consensus that he is going to win re-election. And the primary opposition is a loose coalition of parties that has the acronym INDIA, INDIA, which stands for the Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance.
Yeah.
And so anyway, one of the members of this alliance recently broke away from the alliance and then rejoined the BJP's coalition in his state of Bihar. And he had a very interesting exchange with a farmer from his home state. Let's take a listen to the exchange.
From Maharashtra, let's get you a quick update from Bihar, where the Chief Minister Nitish Kumar, at a function on Tuesday, reprimanded a young farmer for using too many English words. Amit Kumar, a farmer from the Lucky Sarai district, never imagined that speaking in English would make the Bihar Chief Minister angry. At the launch of the fourth agriculture roadmap and consultation program, with farmers who have gathered in Patna from across the state, but it was merely 4 minutes into Mr. Amit's speech when Nitish Kumar interrupted, expressed shock, and said, "What is this? Don't you know this is Bihar? You are using English words. What are you up to? How can you forget that Hindi language is the language of the state and the country?" is what the Bihar Chief Minister Nitish Kumar said. Listen in to this conversation.
I think, Akhil, you can just summarize basically what he said was.
So he basically says here that, that you know, the common man speaks Hindi because Hindi is the language of the state of Bihar, which is not untrue. Although you could, anyway, there is another language, I believe, Maithili. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's a bit of a shame. But he basically says, he reprimands him for saying that, and says that, you know, Hindi is the language of the state, but also the national language. And therefore, you should speak. And also, this is kind of like, it's a little insulting to speak in English when you should be speaking Hindi. And this is, as someone who is from South India, this is like, to me, it seems like a ludicrous claim. This is something that the North Indian politicians do all the time, where they say like Hindi is a national language. And they conflate it being the most populous language from being the national language, right? India has 22 classical languages and no national language, really, because we could never really agree to a national language.
Yeah, what is the population of 1.4 billion? What percentage of people speak Hindi as a first language? It's like a quarter, right?
Yeah, but it's probably, as a first language,
yeah,
probably 400 to 500 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not even half, right?
No.
It's a small percent. The entire south of India, they have their own, you know, rich history and completely independent language. You know, Hindi and, let's say, French actually have more in common than Hindi and the South Indian languages in terms of their roots.
Absolutely. And if you look at the so-called Hindi belt, which consists of basically the Ganges Plain in the northern part of the country, it kind of goes from the north to almost the northeast. But it's surrounded by states, like very populous states, like Maharashtra speaks Marathi, it's where Mumbai is, or Gujarat, which is the state of Narendra Modi, which speaks Gujarati. So it's very interesting for him to say that. And also for him to chastise him for speaking English. India is the second largest English-speaking country in the world.
Yeah, it's the largest English newspapers in the world.
Exactly. And this is, if India ever have a national language, the only language to me that makes sense is English. Because, you know, it's like a common, like, I don't want you to speak your language, you don't want to speak mine, let's just speak this third language that was enforced on us.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he says this almost immediately after we joined the BJP, because that's the BJP's thing, right? That India is a Hindu country, it's a Hindi-speaking country. Yeah. This seems to be very much in line with that.
And it's part of the reason why I actually had a falling out with the India coalition was that, you know, he wanted himself to be the prime ministerial candidate,
yes.
And he was like, you need to have a Hindi speaker as a prime ministerial candidate, as the face of the campaign.
And you know, for some context, like, he comes from a state that has 40 seats in India's parliament, and India's parliament has about like 500 and almost 540 seats. It's about 8 to 9% of parliament, which again is, it might not seem like a lot, but the BJP wins a lot of seats in the Hindi belt.
Yeah, right?
They have like 90% of the seats, it's a stronghold for them.
Yeah, yeah. So it's also interesting. We probably don't have that much time to go further into it, but what is interesting is it's not even clear whether this helps or hurts the India coalition, because by him leaving, they're actually able to kind of distribute. There are all these haggling that happens in India between different parties about who runs and what seats. which I would love to see happen in Canada, actually, if like parties could just sit down and be like, hey, we'll run in those seats and you'll run in these seats. But like they do this haggling, and his party was actually making that kind of haggling very hard. So it actually eases up and allows, you know, different parties to kind of seat share more efficiently. So we'll see what happens. But it does kind of, big picture, it's not a great sign for the India coalition that, like, you know, one of their kind of, let's say, star members is kind of switched political colors in the matter of months.
Absolutely. And it's ripping at the seams, right? There are other players in this coalition as well, regional players who have said that they will run independently in their states as well. So, yeah, it's I think it just it reaffirms the widely held belief that, at least amongst pollsters and people in the media, that Modi's going to win a third term.
Yeah. I don't think we have time for the last clip, but I think we can just talk about the current situation in Gaza. So basically, you know, after launching this military operation that has left over 29,000 people dead in response to the October 7th attacks by Hamas, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has released a plan for the long term of Gaza. To no one's surprise, it does not include a pathway to a two-state solution or any restrictions on future Israeli settlements. Actually, we do have time, so you can play the clip. So meanwhile, in the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, the case regarding Israel's ongoing invasion of Gaza, China, you know, of all countries, has reaffirmed the right of peoples to democracy and self-determination. Let's take a listen to that.
Resolution 3070 of 1973, I quote, reaffirms the legitimacy of the people's struggle for liberation from colonial and foreign domination and alien subjugation by all available means, including armed struggle, end of quote. This recognition is also reflected in international convention. Armed struggle in this context is distinguished from acts of terrorism. It is grounded in the international law.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, you know, what, any reaction to that?
It's very curious that the Chinese foreign minister would say that. Well, I'm very curious to hear what people from the western regions of China, so a couple of autonomous regions in the western part of the country,
or Hong Kong,
have to say about this, or Hong Kong,
or Taiwan. But
you know, one rule for me, another for thee, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that, you know, if we just wrap, you know, in this new era of politics, I think it's something people need to keep in mind is that. People, opportunists, like, I think they're right. You know, Palestinian people do have the right to self-determination, but, you know, malicious, you know, people opportunistically support it in one place. Like, the U.S. supports, you know, self-determination in Ukraine, but not necessarily in action in Palestine, right? So we all support democracy, I hope. But, you know, states will opportunistically support it.
When it benefits them. Absolutely. And authoritarian ones, especially at that.
Yeah.
So a few other things to wrap up. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. You can find us at The Ermanic Hill on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there.
Yeah.
Well, we do have some awesome shows lined up with a set of amazing guests. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out.
And Song of the Meast by Sarah Pratt to take things away.